My frail grandmother. Here we are, Baruch Hashem, less than a week to go until Purim. And I want to thank each and every one of you for carving out the time to come together and to prepare together. I think we've thought about this in the past, in advance of various Yom Tovim, and I think for Purim it's especially so. There's so much practical preparation that goes into it, Baruch Hashem. A busy day full of mitzvahs masios, a lot of hands-on mitzvahs that require a lot of hands-on work on Purim, require a lot of hands-on work in advance of Purim. And there's no Isser Malacha in the full sense, and it's one day. So it's sort of like a perfect storm. It's so easy to sort of go into Purim and come out of Purim, and Baruch Hashem, I did Purim, but did Purim do me? I did all the Maisim. I heard Megillah, and Matan Sevel, Mishalach Malach, Sud is Purim. I did the things I was supposed to do, but did the Purim do me? Did the Purim impact me? And so some of the idea that many of us have thought about together in the past is that, as Rav Kook writes, Ein Kedusha B'lo Hachana. If you want to grow and gain, there needs to be preparation in advance. And there certainly is physical preparation, hands-on, practical preparation for the mitzvahs. It could be that the roasts are already being thawed and the kugels are already being baked. But to prepare, a penimius preparation as well. To prepare intellectually, spiritually, emotionally, to think about the ideas and to invest ourselves in advance. If we take the time now, Baruch Hashem, it came together, carved out some time to come together and to think and learn, to reflect on Purim in advance, so that when we're on the move over the course of Purim, it can be a multi-layered experience, and that all the mitzvahs nasis, all the holy busyness of Purim, hopefully will be that much more profound for us, that much more thoughtful, if you already have a chance to prepare in advance. I want to take a look tonight specifically, this is in the context of our Wednesday night Nach, to spend the night on Megillas Esther, and to do it like last year, but different than last year. Last year we should spend a couple weeks in Megillas Esther, and last year we built it around, we found the structure. The Megillas Esther is, you know, something that's familiar, and yet gotta tap into the newness. And so last year we used the structure that the Tanaim introduced us to. Last year we looked at the fact that in the second paragraph of Maseches Megillah, there are three opinions in the Mishnah and a fourth opinion of Raisa. Where do you start? How much of the Megillah do you read? And that really set us up for sort of four different perspectives on the Megillah. Is it the story of Achashverosh? Is it the story of Mordechai? Is it the story of Haman? Or the story of the Nes? But to think about those halachic categories as also ways of looking at the Sefer and ways of appreciating, understanding the Sefer. And what I want to do tonight is to take a different structure that you find in the Maseches Megillah. Come on in, make yourself comfortable. There are packets up there. Help yourself. Take a look at, for tonight, a different structure. Gemara in the first paragraph of Maseches Megillah has a very extensive medrash. There are a few times throughout Shas, in the Talmud Bavli will switch into medrash mode, take a piece of the Tanakh, and comment line by line, pasuk by pasuk. I think the longest chunk, as far as I know, anywhere in the Bavli, is the last six and a half blocks of the first parak are a full Medrash Esther, pasuk by pasuk from beginning to end. What's intriguing, though, is there's an added feature. They have in some other Midrashim as well. Davirah Mabez, the Gemara starts at two dots. Here now, Hashverosh begins to comment on the first pasuk, and then picks up with that on Yud-Aleph Amud Aleph. What happens in between is a series of different Amoraim talking about how the Gemara records how each one was pasach. You have this in front of in the packet in front of you. For instance, Rabbi Yochanan Yonasan pasach lapisla lahi parshas amehacha. Rabbi Yonasan opened up this parsha, opened up Megillas Esther with the following pasuk in Yeshayahu. Quotes the pasuk in the comment. He's the next one. Rishul bar Nachmeni, number two, pasuk lapisla lahi parshas amehacha. He opened it with a different pasuk in Yeshayahu, a very familiar one. Pachas natzutzei yalev rosh. They go on and on and on. She would lay these open the pasuk in Chumash Dvarim. Rabbi Rokahan number four pasuk in Koheles. And you turn the page, Yirmiyahu and Ezra and so on and so forth. What's going on? It's well over an amud. It's a better part of a blot of Gemara. 18 different amaram according to the Graz Girsa, the way I presented it here. 18 different amaram. Each one says he would open the Megillah with the following pasuk. He would open the Megillah with the following pasuk. I was actually discussing this with one of my boys. I said to them, well, what is this? Almost a blot of Gemara. I'm not sure what's going on. It seems like little comments. For instance.
Like people laying in shul or in his
good. So it doesn't sound like. Good. There are other midrashim that also have a psichta, that have an opening before you actually get to Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. Yeah, and Rashi says that when Kishai wrote to Ledrosh, the Inyan Igeres Purim, that they were going to give a shir on the Megillah, interestingly, language Igeres Purim, that's one of the ways the Megillah describes itself at the end of the ninth parak. So this is what they would open. Now, so what's the significance of this? So the Ben Yehoyada, Sfardi Sefer on Agarta and Gemara, so he understands that all of these are specifically addressing one question, which is, why were the Jews ultimately saved? Jews had committed a chet, the Gemara tells us. They participated inappropriately in the suit of Achashverosh, inappropriate on a whole bunch of levels. So Ben Yehoyada says, each one is giving an explanation to how come they were ultimately saved. I would suggest that it could be there's a broader picture here as well. And I think it's borne out if you look in Rashi. It may be indeed that many of them are addressing that question, but there's something larger going on here as well. As Rashi says, this is how they would open a shir. They want to give a shir on Esther, so each one had his go-to pasuk. Each one has go-to pasuk. I believe part of what's going on here is they're identifying the themes of the Megillah. If I'm going to learn the Megillah, so there's so many different angles you could take. You could learn the Megillah as lessons about how Jews ought to interact with non-Jews. You can learn the Megillah as insight into how HaKadosh Baruch Hu, protects the Jewish people. You can learn the Megillah as a story of Schar V'Onesh. You can learn the Megillah as a story, as different perspectives on pleasure. Right? Certainly, a tremendous amount of focus in the beginning. Achashverosh, like almost like a caricature of pleasure, like run amok. I think you see where that goes. There's so many different ways that we could, so many different angles we could take in learning the Megillah. So many different dimensions. Which dimension are you going to pick? Which theme is going to drive the way you learn the Megillah? And I believe that that's at least part of what the Amoraim are giving us, and part of why the Gemara spends so much time telling us about 18 different Amoraim and how each one opened it up. And that appears at the very beginning of the Limud. Get our feet wet with the first pasuk, and then move right into the 18 psichos. Probably, at least in part, because the Gemara is giving us a sense of what are the different themes that you could focus on. And perhaps, number one, just in terms of method, to know that different Amoraim Taka did focus on different themes. When I'm going to sit down to learn the Megillah, that might focus on one or the other, or it could be different times, different years, different angles will speak to me. So what I'd love to do is, as the title indicates, to open the Megillah together in Amoraim. Here's our opportunity. To begin Megillah Esther. To begin Megillah Esther, sitting on the shoulder of Rav Avraham Bar Kahana. To begin Megillah Esther, sitting on the shoulder of Shmuel. Sitting on the shoulders of Rav, of Nachum Bar Yitzchak. What I'd love to do is two things. The time that we have. First, to do a quicker run through, just sort of to see some of the themes that pop out, and then we'll have the chance to dig in to several of them, and hopefully help to perhaps whet your appetite to explore this more, and certainly give us more perspective as we have whatever time we have to learn the Megillah and to listen to the Megillah, and it'll help shape our thinking about the story of Purim, the different aspects and lessons we're supposed to draw, from the story of Purim that we're meant to invest into the mitzvahs of Purim. So let's begin to skim. Let's begin to skim. We'll just first, as I said, pick out some of the themes that leap to the eye. The first one, Rabbi Yonah said, number one, he talks about language. The downfall of Babel, specifically the focus on Zehaksav, the Zehalashon. And language, in fact, is, it doesn't strike you at first, once you start thinking about it, language is a recurring theme in the Megillah. There's incredible stress repeatedly on things being translated to every single language, and different cultures, different languages. And there's an incredible amount of power of language, the interplay between what Haman thinks and what Haman says. Throughout the Megillah, one angle to all keep your eyes open to is the power of language. Number two, a very, very familiar pasuk. Ushur ben Achmini says that means that Mordechai Barosh took the place of Haman, Na'atzutz, and Hadas, as Esther, took the place of the Sirpad of Vashti, the theme of a very dominant theme, the fall of Rishayim and the rise of Tzadikim. That notion of Tzadikim taking the place of Rishayim over the course of time, that sort of flow to the story, it's definitely a very key theme. Number three, Rishu ben Levi brings us to Simcha. Kasher Sas Hashem Aleichem Leitiv Eschem. He talks about Simcha. Sometimes Simcha in ways that we're happy about, and sometimes, as we'll return to number three, Simcha sometimes in ways that are frightening. But Simcha is definitely a very dominant theme of Purim. And if you think about it in the Megillah as well, not just in Perek Tes, where you hear about the halachos of Purim, but we hear about different types of Simcha over the course of the Megillah. Haman is happy. When Haman is happy, we're not necessarily happy. Later on, Hayishashan Sa'alav is Amecha, but to track the flow of happiness. And moving on to number five, the Santikis Ibe Elam, the next page. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's throne, Kisei Hashem, Abba Ofran, what that means is a good question. Maybe we'll have time to take a peek at that. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Ki Yad Al Kes Ka, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's throne right appears in Peshalach in the first encounter with Amalek, and it is once again here in the story of the Megillah. Number six, and number seven, bring us to Mesiras Nefesh. The notion of Banu Ba'eshu Ba'mayim in number seven. The days of Achashver, and the days of Nuchanetzer, and days of Paro, to think about Mesiras Nefesh as a theme. Pasuk Ches, and the number eight rather, Rabbi Yochanan, talks about the non-Jews recognizing HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Number nine, which we'll return to soon, is a focus on pleasure, which, as we noted, is definitely a Megillah theme. Then, as you move on to the next few, in number 10, Rabbi Elazar is talking about Midos. And in number 11, as we'll see, Rabbi Nachman Yitzchak is talking about power. And then in number 12, we're looking at the relationship between Jews and non-Jews. And then the last you look at the Jews in Galus. So that was round one. We're just getting our feet wet here, looking at, very quickly scanning before we dig into several of them, just gain a little bit of a flavor of the 18 Chai Amoraim. You already see so many different perspectives. As we said, you could look at Yisrael V'Amim, you could look at pleasure, you could look at power, you could look at HaKadosh Baruch Hu Hashkacha Pratis, you could look at Simcha, you could look at the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, so to speak. The fall of the Rishon and the rise of the Deacon. You look at the power of language. So if we stopped here, we would already walk out with so much. Because if we stopped here, we would already walk out with an appreciation that Purim is so multi-layered. The Megillah is so multi-layered, such that 18 Amoraim can each look at the same Megillah. Hi, well, come on in. Welcome in. 18 Amoraim can each look at the same Megillah, and each one finds a different theme to focus on, and as a result, come back to the specifics of our Gemara, each one would open his shiur from a different perspective. And he would have some pasuk, Pasuk Lapisah, we would open up with a pasuk from somewhere else in Tanakh, in the Chumash Nevi'im or one of the other Sefer Ksuvim, and then sort of set the stage. Set the stage for what he wanted to talk about. So that already gets us thinking, all these different ideas. It gets us thinking without thinking. Clearly they were learning Megillas Esther very deeply. And that's something that itself is an important hakana
for Purim.
To remind ourselves that Purim is certainly Yom Tov for children, and it's certainly at the same time, obviously, after just a moment's reflection, not only Yom Tov for children. Megillas Esther is a story for children. But it's obviously not only a story for children. They were not Mesakin Yom Tov just for children. Children appreciate it in particular ways, Baruch Hashem, as they should. And as adults, we ought to appreciate it in an even richer array of ways. We can enjoy it the way the kids enjoy it, but there are whole other layers we're going to enjoy so much more when we're tapped in. There's so much going on in this Yom Tov. So many Kari Ayazos we just spoke about. So many aspects of Machshava, so many aspects of Tikkun Amidus, so many aspects of growth, so much to think about. So let's now move on to step two. Let's do some more targeted thinking. Obviously, we don't have time to go through all of these. Would be Baruch Hashem. That would be a whole series of shiurim, maybe some other time. But for now, yeah, question.
Is there any order to these anything?
I was wondering about that also. It's as far as I can tell, it's definitely not chronological.
Not at all.
What's actually surprising is that
almost.
Like the first generation of Amoraim are number three, we should have been Levi, but then mostly towards the end. Rav and Shmuel are 15 and 16. Rabbi Chiya is number 18.
It's not the source
of something. Yeah, I'm not sure. It's a little bit of the very, very short ones are towards the end. At the end, you just have to show the psuk. You see there, number 13, 14, 15, 17, 18. They just say the pasuk. And no comment. No comment preserved. The other ones have some comments. Some are long, some are shorter. Another early Amor is Rish Lakish, number 9, or Yochanan, number 8. Yeah, it seems like it's very intermingled. I'm not sure. Nor is it alphabetical. That's a great question. I'm not sure. And as a result of that, we're actually going to skip around a little bit. Exactly because of that. We'll skip around a little bit. I would say, in thinking about what we just saw, we just sort of surveyed the terrain a little bit. It got our feet wet, and it got as we always point out, it's hard to know what the order is, but it's such a diverse array of themes and ideas. As we begin to process it a little bit, number one, we're struck by the fact that some of them are positive and some of them are negative. Some of them have to do with the tzara, the negative, some have to do with the Yeshua. And moreover, some have to do with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, some have to do with people. Some have to do with HaKadosh Baruch Hu taking care of that. Some have to do with us reaching out. And specifically us reaching out positively or negatively. So what I'd love to do is over the remainder of the shiur, step two, to look at a number of these, zero in a number of these specifically, and maybe sort of organize the following way. Maybe let's start with one that talks about the plot, the dynamics of the story. And then we'll move to Klal Yisrael for some of the negatives, and then some of the positives. Then we'll end with some of the ones that deal with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that focus on HaKadosh Baruch Hu's role in the Gila, and we'll see that in a certain sense we're going to end back where we began. So again, dynamics of plot, Chatam of Klal Yisrael, the mitzvahs of Klal Yisrael, and finally those themes that focus on Ribono Shel Olam. Dynamics of plot bring us to number 12. Rava. Around the middle of the list and around the middle of the Amora. Rava Pasuk Lapisah LaKarshasav. But in case you wanna just a bibliographical note, in case you wanna later open up the Gemara and take a look inside, so I highlighted this begins in the middle of Megillah Yud Aleph Beis, and in the middle of number 6, I marked off where you turn the Amud to Yud Aleph Amud Aleph. So here we are, number 12, the dynamics of the plot. Rava Pasuk Lapisah LaKarshasav. Rava opened his shiur with the pasuk in Mishlei, "Birvos tzadikim yisnach ha'am, uvimshol rasha ye'enach ha'am." When the tzadikim either grow many or grow more powerful, Marsha is not sure, It's what? He raises both possibilities. Then the nation is happy. Yismacha. When a Russia is in charge, ye'enacha. A nation groans. A nation crests. And Rava says, that captures the story, or one aspect, one thread of the story of the Megillah. Verbosa, Dikim Yismacha, number 12. Zeh Mordechai ve'Esther. How do you know people are happy? That's what it says. Ha'yushu Shar, Tzal Lov V'Sameicha. Once, Mordechai is in charge. When the Russia was in charge, they were groaning, Zehama, by Yir Shushan Nabochim. So certainly, Bigadol, Rava is capturing the theme of Simcha, and Rava is speaking to the theme of Yisrael Yamin. But more specifically, because you're in one additional angle here, the Marsha points out, Masha has a couple of comments. He has a Masha is a running commentary in the Akadatas of Shas. Some of his comments on this particular aspect actually relate to an idea that the Malbim has in reading the Psukim of the Megillah. The Masha points out that there's a slight shift. Birvos ha-tzadikim yismach ha'am. U'mushol rasha yenach am. No hey. The nation is happy. The tzadikim are in charge. Nation, or maybe many nations, are groaning when Haman is in charge. So the Marsha suggests that when Mordechai and Esther come to power, they communicate clearly. And they put out a letter that says clearly, the Jews will be safe. And the Jews, as a result, it's clear in that context that specifically the Jews are happy and relieved. Earlier, the Mishol Rasha Yenach Am, Muhammad was in charge. It wasn't just the one nation, the Jewish people, who were groaning. It was everyone. But Yishushan, here looks fast. Yishushan Navocha doesn't say sad. Or notice. Yishushan, we may have discussed this last year in the Shir Master, that we assume that means sad because it's Eichatrap. But Navocha means confused. Why were they confused? So the Malbim talked about this at length, but the Marsha already says this very briefly here. Says that the outside, the Pesukim go on to say that wherever there were Jews, there was Evel, Gadol, Bechi, Sak, Mispeh, the Jews were frightened because the letter that arrived, the far-flung location, said that the Jews are in danger. In Shushan, the communication was very muted. Things are going to happen. It was Malcolm developed that Haman was trying to be strategic. He didn't want Ahasuerus to know too much. So within Shushan, they were confused. They were Navo. Not just the Jews. Everyone. So that's so number 12, Rava speaks to Simcha, speaks to Yisrael the Amin, and speaks to some of the dynamics. He's already grabbing some of the dynamics of the plot and some of the ways in which Haman was incredibly strategic in a negative sense, while Mordechai had clear goals and was willing to be clear about what he wanted and how he wanted to proceed. Moving backwards, please.
Words, I don't even know how to pronounce it. The word before tzadikim versus dimshol Russia. What is that? What are those two contrasting words? Because they don't seem exactly parallel.
Yeah, that's a good point. The Marsha discusses birvos tzadikim. It sounds like, from a Hebrew sense, it sounds like when they grow.
Right.
What does that mean?
A lot.
So he suggests that it may be from the Aramaic. In Daniel, I think he came across this, the word revu, or revusa, which you have in some of his mirrors on Shabbos and in Akdamas, revu in Aramaic means strength or power. Because when the tzaddikim were in charge, then it is pretty parallel to the Mishol Rasha. Now, if we move from sort of heading number one, the dynamics of the plot, into things that are more thematic. In specific, let's move to the Chatam of the Jews and then to the Mitzvahs of the Jews. From the Chatam of the Jews, again, we're not going to see everything, but let's step into number 10, Rabbi Elazar. There's a little bit of flow here, diaspora flow, but 8, 9, 10, Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shakesh of Elazar, the Shakesh of Elazar are both Talmidim Chadeim of Rabbi Yochanan. So we have at least a little bit of a historical pocket here. Rabbi Lazar points to a pasuk in Kohelet. Ba'atal tayni macha mekareh. U'v'shiflus yadayim yidlof habayis. When people are lazy, things fall apart. The roof begins to fall apart, and things begin to drip. So what? What does that have to do with the story of Gilzaster? So Rabbi Lazar comments, "B'shvil atzlus shahaya lavli yisrael shalosku the Torah." Because they were lazy, they weren't involved in learning. Nasa so naosha Hakadosh Baruch Hu mach. They made, and that's a euphemism. We don't want to say that Hakadosh Baruch Hu became weak. So instead we say he who hates Hakadosh Baruch Hu. That's a euphemism. What we really mean to say is they, so to speak, weakened Hakadosh Baruch Hu. Meaning Hakadosh Baruch Hu chose. To be clear, God is independent. The Kadosh Baruch Hu chose me to connect with Mida, and we were being lazy, so he was going to respond by not controlling things as powerfully. The Kadosh Baruch Hu chose to step back and let things unfold temporarily in an unpleasant way. So one of the things Rav Lazar pointed out to us is we don't usually think about Midos as a driver of the story of Gilzaster. But it is. That's what Gilzaster said. That there were failings of Midos that lay at the root of what was going on. It all started, if you trace it back, well, it all starts with Midos, and if you look at it that way, so that opens interesting possibilities. Because then you can begin to think about, well, where else? Because Rabbi Lazar is saying that the hidden backstory, what happens in Parak Zero, what happens before the story of Milah gets rolling, is we were already chote a chet of atzlos, a chet of laziness, and we were slacking off, and that's why we experienced, so to speak, a ke'ilu, a divine slacking off. So then it gets you wondering, what other failings of me, is this a thread that runs throughout? So certainly there's Gaiva. There's loads of ego in the opening of Kiprakim. Achashverosh is seeking, according to the Malbim, absolute power. The Malbim read the whole first paragraph of the Megillah. He's angling to put himself even firmer place. Haman is clearly driven by unremitting ego throughout. And what else might there be? So step back now to Belazar Zachaver Rish Lakish, number 9. He points to a pasuk from a different Sefer written by Shlomo HaMelech, not Kohelet, but Mishlei. Ari Nohem, the Dove Showcase, Moshel Rasha Amdal. The lion is roaring. The lion is roaring. And the bear is feasting. The Rasha rules over the poor nation. Apostle in Mishlei. What does that mean? So Rish Lakish unpacks it. Ari Nohem is the Nebuchadnezzar. He's described by Yirmiyahu as a lion. Achashverosh, the Persians in general, described as bears. You think about the Russian bear. But before the Russian bear, there was the Persian bear. And then, that the Moshel Rashal Amdal, that's Haman, in charge for a while of the Jewish people. Okay. Why is Achashverosh referred to as a bear, specifically a feasting bear. So first, of course, the pasuk in Daniel that seems to relate in one of his visions, there's a bear that's a symbol for Persia. And then, of course, the commentator of Yosef, Elu Parsiim, the bear symbolizes the Persians. Why? Sha'ochim is the Persian Empire, Achashverosh. Sha'ochim v'shos in Kedov, they eat and drink like a bear. Mr. Bal and Basar Kedov, and they're pudgy like a bear. Megadon Seir Kedov, they're hairy like the bear. The Ein Lehem Menucha Kedov, and they're restless like a bear. So it's certainly true that bears, in part because they hibernate throughout the winter, so they go through these periods of intense hunger before they're preparing. And when they come out in springtime, I believe also, famished. But what's this supposed to mean? So what are we saying? What's the point? Achashverosh, he was definitely a party animal. No two ways about that. That's the first thing you hear about Kasher. The most dominant thing you hear about it is all the details of the decor. Everything is there in excruciating detail. And there's more. Because the one piece that doesn't fit in, Eilam Menucha Kido, maybe that bears often also seem restless. But how does that fit in? I wonder whether it means the following. Ramban writes many weeks ago, several months ago, in talking about the Avos are described often as being old and Saveya, old Savayamim. Ramban wants to know what does that mean. So he says something fascinating. He says a stira between Shlomo and David. Does it exactly present this way? But more or less. It says stira between Shlomo and David. Shlomo tells us, Oyev Kesef, Oyev Kesef. You love money, it's never enough. You have 100, you want 200, you have 200, you want 400. It always, whenever we get something, that is the thing that's going to make us happy. As soon as we get there, we're ready to be near 2x. It's always a moving goalpost. So Rabban says, okay, that's what Shlomo says. But David HaMelech tells us in Tehillim, Shlomo's father, Tavas Libo Nosatalo, that you gave this tzaddik his what he wanted. So Rabban says, which one is it? Are we implacable? Are we unsatiable? Can human beings never be satisfied? Or no? It's possible. Tavas Libo Nosatalo, you got everything you want. Rabban says, the answer is, who are we talking about? The way Shlomo starts, he doesn't say, Adam lo yisba kesef. He doesn't say, people are never happy. He says, Oed kesef, lo yisba kesef. He says, when physical possessions become the purpose, when they become the goal, instead of something to enjoy, or something to use, or something to enjoy on the way towards greater goals, when they become the goal, or to put it a different way, when wants become needs, so then you've just locked yourself in to a vicious cycle of unhappiness. Because once it becomes a need, so then it's never going to be enough. And when that becomes if that becomes the dominant way towards happiness, is you're just like a hamster on the wheel. You're just going to keep going and going and going. You're never getting anywhere. So Ramban writes, the Avos were people, they always went through certainly periods in their lives where they were very, very wealthy. Incredibly wealthy. He says, but they weren't seeking mosaros. That's not what life was about. They had luxuries. Okay, they enjoyed them. If they didn't have them, they didn't enjoy them. It wasn't the need. It wasn't the goal. If it's there, good. Kadosh Baruch Hu gave me this. I'll enjoy it. And if not, I won't. That's not the purpose. Even when I have it, it's not the purpose. It's not the goal. That's not what it's all about. They have their eyes on the real prize. So I wonder if that's what, as he says, Ramban says, that's how you resolve Oyev Kesef Yisba Kesef versus Tavos Libo Nosatalo. Sometimes you can choose to be the sort of person who can be satiated. And that's why the Avos are described as Sevah Yamin. They were satisfied. Maybe that's what Reish Lakish is driving at also, here in number 9. This image of being eating and drinking to excess, it's not just eating to live, nor is it even, okay, I happen to have something nice to enjoy, so I'll enjoy it on my way towards my real goals. But this is sort of a picture, and certainly HaShverosh fits that, like a glove. He's all about the pleasure, he's like run amok. The way he described his searching for another wife, it's nauseating. And then Eilam Menucha. If that's the way you're going to live, so then that doesn't mean you'll go to sleep. It means you'll never be satisfied. There's always an itch. It's never enough. And then how does he end? Haman was Moshel al Amdal. The Jewish people were dalim min mitzvahs. We were impoverished from mitzvahs. We were poor of mitzvahs. Perhaps what he's driving at is we had fallen into that same trap. Not only as Rabbi Elazar points out, there was the midara of atzlos. There was also another flaw that we had to grapple with, was we had fallen in with Persian culture, not just with the details, but the mindset that we had become a pleasure-driven people, not a God-driven people, and along the way there may be pleasures that we enjoy. It became all about pleasure. So we were dalim in hamitzvahs, and that's exactly why we fell to the. We were temporarily under their thumb. Yeah.
I'm very familiar with the. I feel like you often learn in when you're learning about the Megillah, the Zal, or that they fell into the Persian culture. But the Asaltayim Yamecha, is there like evidence in the Megillah for that Nida?
I'm not sure.
Or it's very distorted.
I'm not sure. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know if there's evidence in the Megillah itself for the Nida of Atzlos. Certainly, Nidos in general, and perhaps also this question of, and then if you want to differentiate a little bit, if Rebbe Lazar number 10 is focusing us on laziness in particular and Nidos in general, Reish Lakish is focusing us on not the same as Nidos, but a question of priorities. What are your priorities and what's life without? And that's something that we had, Achashverosh presents us with, again, a sort of an extreme picture of what does it like look like when you become pleasure-seeking in the extreme. So hopefully we're nowhere near Achashverosh, but there's a little bit of Achashverosh inside each of us. You know, in a far more mild way, but do we get carried away with it? As opposed to, you know, keeping everything in proper perspective. Yeah, I can enjoy it, but it's not who I am. It doesn't define me. It's not my goal. It's not my dream. It's something I can enjoy along the way. So, and to the extent that we sinned in that somehow, we were slightly flawed in our relationship with pleasure. So me and Agamida, we fell into someone whose priorities were entirely off. Now let's turn from the negatives of Klal Yisrael to the positives. And let's jump back to Avdim Vayitzlak in number 6. And then we'll come to number 7. Number 6, Avdim Vayitzlak. Pasuk L'Pisrael Parsh Tameacha. He opened his Shi'urim on Esther from Pasuk in Ezra. Ki avadim anachnu, v'avodaseinu lo azabnu elokeinu. We're slaves, we're not free, we're part of the empire, but yet, v'avoduseinu perhaps, where we haven't let go of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu rains his chesed upon us, lifnei ma'achei pras. HaKadosh Baruch Hu started with that we would be motzei chein, be'enei the Persian Empire, and that indeed is the story of Ezra, who during the reign of a later Persian emperor, Koresh. Koresh is ready to send the Jewish people back there to Israel. He's ready to allow, he authorizes the Jews to return under the leadership of Ezra. He appoints Ezra the chief rabbi. I think, as far as you know, Ezra is the first governmentally appointed rabbi in Jewish history. And he instructs them to rebuild Yerushalayim, to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Amosai Bizman Haman. It's interesting. Now, I would have said, as we're talking about a generation or two later, Koresh. Rav Dimek says, well, it's already in play in the days of Haman. It's already, the tide is already, what he's saying is, L'chora, Purim is the beginning of the movement, of the shift in Persian thinking that ultimately grows into, you can go back and build the second base of nature. This is the seeds of Geula. It sounds like he's also saying, we didn't forget HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We were stuck and we were down. We didn't forget HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That too is in the days of Haman. And in number 7, Rechim Bar Papa talks about a few things. But one of them is Jewish Mesiras Nefesh. Rechim Bar Papa points to Pasuk in Tilim. Hikavta Enosh L'Roshenu. You had a man riding on our head. Banu Ba'eshu V'mayim. We went through fire and water. But you brought us out ultimately into a place of greater safety. What's it all about? The Eish of Amayim, Rechim Bar Papa says, is Eish is a reference to Nebuchadnezzar. Mayim is a reference to Paro. Paro wanted to kill us with water. He did kill many of us with water. Nebuchadnezzar wanted to, you remember the story we learned in Daniel last year. Everyone has to bow the statue or so they'll be thrown into the fiery cauldron. And fiery first, indeed, are thrown in, miraculously saved. In other words, so what's Rechim Bar Papa saying? We were Moser Nefesh in earlier generations. Later on, you saved us in the days of Haman.
Is that the smicha of Pesach
to Purim? That's interesting. That's fascinating. That's actually fascinating. Right? Because he's saying that the Mesiras Nefesh in the days of Pesach was still paying dividends. That's fascinating. Still paying dividends in the days of Purim. And this tells us so much so much. It speaks, number one, to our Mesiris Nefesh. And here we also shift. We say we want to talk about a little bit of the dynamics of the plot, which we did. Talk a little about the Chatan of Klal Yisrael, which are the flaws that we need to, perhaps Purim is a particularly appropriate time to address those questions of midos, those questions of priorities. And now we're beginning to look at the mitzvahs and miles of Klal Yisrael. We're seeing the Mesiris Nefesh and the clarity. And this also allows us to transition to the final leg of our exploration of these themes, and that is to focus on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because this, Chinuch Bar Papa, his analysis of this pasuk in Tehillim, Perek Samach Vav, so it speaks to Klal Yisrael, and it also speaks to Ribono Shel Olam. It speaks to the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu handles us. Because one of the themes that we mentioned before is a theme of power. And who has power and what happens with power, how people use power, and the things that people do to get power and how people lose power, the dynamics of the Persian court are definitely a very dramatic piece of the puzzle of Megillas Esther. Take a look at number 11, with Nachum Bar Yitzchak, points to a pasuk in the Shir HaMaalos. Shir HaMaalos, Lulei Hashem Shaya Lanu Yamanu Yisrael, Lulei Hashem Shaya Lanu, V'kum Aleinu Adam. What does that have to do with the Megillah? So he only comments. This is already in the part of the Megillah because it means like a short pattern, mostly a puzzle. It's Adam v'lo Melech, the person, not a king. What does that do for me? What does it mean? Person, not a king. So Rashi here, and Tosfos in Avodah Zarah, that Rabbi Akiva Eger sent you to, both comment that this is a reference to Haman. As the man who was in charge, the man who was the Kum Aleinu Adam, he wasn't the king. He wasn't Achashverosh. Achashverosh may or may not have been complicit. That's a larger conversation. But certainly the driver was Haman. And what's the point? Okay. So he was a person and not a king. And therefore. So I think part of what Nachritzik is capturing is that there's a double irony here. Who's really in charge? So on one level, Adam v'lo Melech. In other words, Haman sought power. Haman, driven by his incredible ego, he's seeking power. He's clearly angling for it. Achashverosh also realizes he's worried that Haman's trying to unseat him. Maybe Achashverosh thinks maybe it's in cahoots with Esther. But Haman, in a certain sense, was right. The power was not, and that visual of Achashverosh takes off the ring and gives it to Haman, you're in charge. Achashverosh ultimately regrets it. But Haman is playing it for a while. Haman is playing Achashverosh like a violin. In theory, Achashverosh is the king. But the real power is in the hands of Haman. Adam v'lo Melech. The man who's actually acted the Jewish people wasn't even officially the king. But he was the one who had the real power. Or did he? And that's the double irony. The first level of irony is the man who's in charge isn't even the king. The man who's in charge of HaMelech. But of course, the deeper irony is that no person is really in charge. Haman thinks he has it all tied up in a bow. Nefesh Baruch Hu totally upends it. And that's explicitly said in the Megillah. It tells him, oh, you're starting with the Jews? And his own wife says, this is not going to go the way you think it's going to go. So that's sort of like the double irony, questions of power. That's a piece of it. Who's really in charge? Interactions with the people often are not as they seem. But then to also look beyond that, to recognize ultimately, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was the one who's writing the show. And finally. Let's take it back to number 7. Number 7, in Chinuch Bar Papa, Chinuch Bar Papa, the Hirkav to Enosh Roshenu, Banu Ba'esh Ramayim. Banu Ba'esh Ramayim. So, as we said before, part of what he's capturing is the Mesiris Nefesh of Klal Yisrael. That we suffered and we were ready to lie down for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that matter. What's also interesting is that what it teaches us now from the other angle, looking at that in terms of Hanhagas Habore rather than Hanhagas Adam, what Ruchinia Papa is telling us is really remarkable, and that's what Michael was saying before. We suffered in Mitzrayim, and the Schar came 1,000 years later, almost 1,000 years later, the days of Purim. Remarkable? Think about that. In Mitzrayim, it was horrific. And at that point, Mitzrayim was horrific. What good is this? How is this possibly? How is this? Where is Ribbono Shel Olam? And in the moment, he was invisible. Unless you were looking very, very carefully. But the schar would come later. No one is capturing just the notion that there's a wholeness to Jewish history, sort of the theme of Mao's tour. But the story there's a continuity from the story of Pesach to Purim to Chanukah all the way until the Gula Asida. And to recognize that the schar often doesn't come right away. It doesn't mean that it's not coming. And we'll close where we began in this theme, but coming back to the theme of Simcha. Because in number 3, Rishuah ben Levi says, Pasuk in Ender Chumash Devarim, Kasher sas Hashem alechem leitiv eschem, kein yosis lahara eschem. This is how Kadosh Baruch Hu was thrilled to do good, so too yosis, he will, yosis, to do bad. The Gemara says, really? Kadosh Baruch Hu was happy? Kadosh Baruch Hu happy even when a Russia has a downfall. So that Rishulayev's comment ends, it doesn't say Yasus. Hakadosh Baruch Hu was not happy. He will cause others to be happy in temporarily persecuting us. And that's exactly what happens. Haman has Simcha. He has plenty of Simcha temporarily. But hereby I'm going to the parties and he's thrilled. And that was part of Hakadosh Baruch Hu's plan. But Hakadosh Baruch Hu was often the misterative connection, the Gemara and Chagig comments based on the Psukim. That we're at a time of Galus, Kadosh Baruch Hu was crying for Klal Yisrael quietly, in private chambers. We don't necessarily see it. Things look like they're on the outside going very nicely, even though we're in Galus. Kadosh Baruch Hu was being Mesis Achirim, but his actual sustenance is reserved for the sustenance that he has when Klal Yisrael come back to their correct position, which is the ultimate end of the story that Purim gets us started in heading towards the Geula of the second Beis HaMikdash and the full Geula, which is a continuation of the story of Purim. I want to thank you so much for coming out. This will elevate our thinking, elevate our feeling, elevate our penis, elevate our mitzvahs and our experience of Purim. Thank you so much.